For the first time in years, there's talk of a possible peace settlement in Ukraine. National attention at present is focused on the negotiation process, but largely ignored is what the aftermath of the war will look like for both Ukraine and Russia. Today, I want to give you a glimpse of the immense challenges that lie ahead whenever peace is fully achieved. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Upsize Your Leadership, the podcast about enhancing your effectiveness wherever you lead, whatever your role. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Dr. Mike Armour, President of Strategic Leadership Development International, which I founded in 2001. We are a comprehensive leadership development firm serving clients nationwide from Dallas. You can learn more about me and the services we offer at leaderperfect.com. I begin today with an apology for having gone silent on you for several weeks. In February, I developed bronchial congestion that got steadily worse to the point that I was coughing continuously. The resulting damage to my vocal cords forced me to postpone further episodes of Upsize Your Leadership until my voice was more reliable. I'm glad to finally be back behind the microphone. While I was out of circulation, Ukraine was in the news almost nightly, this time not because of the battlefield, but because of efforts at the negotiating table. As longtime listeners know, I've used this podcast several times in the past to take my listeners behind the scenes of what has been happening in Ukraine. For several years, I ran an office and had several employees in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, where the fighting has been the most ferocious. I've therefore followed development in the war carefully and daily. My sympathies are unquestionably with the Ukrainians in this conflict. I would love to see them prevail. Reality, however, suggests that victory by neither side is a likely prospect. As a military historian by training and a retired Navy captain, I've studied many historic wars that fought to an impasse. From what I can tell, Ukraine is at that point now. The final boundary lines will probably not be of my liking, but I'm resigned to that. And lately, I've been analyzing the problems that post-war Ukraine will have to surmount. Let me share some of those issues with you over the next few minutes. As great as the leadership challenges have been in the course of the war, the challenges of post-war Ukraine will be no less staggering. I will fill you in momentarily, so stand by. I'll be back in just a minute.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
For several years, I managed a nationwide operation in Ukraine. We were headquartered in Donetsk, but operated everywhere from Crimea in the southeast to the Carpathian Mountains in the northwest. Most of the people with whom we worked were ordinary citizens, coal miners, teachers, nurses, small business owners. Although we often interfaced with top officials, even those around the president, we spent little time with them. What I know best about Ukraine, therefore, was learned at the street level. From that perspective, I want to analyze the enormity of the task that post-war Ukraine will face. First, it will have a dearth of young families. Prior to the war, both Ukraine and Russia were facing an undersized population in the age range of 20 to 35. If we divided the population into 10-year cohorts, the smallest cohort was in the middle of this range. The men in that cohort bore the brunt of the fighting, and therefore casualties, in the earliest months of the fighting. They suffered horrendous losses. To replace casualties on the battlefront, Ukraine had to start drafting middle-aged men. At one point a few months ago, I saw an internal report indicating that the average age of a combatant on the front lines was 43. While men in their 20s and 30s were prohibited from leaving the country, their wives and children were allowed to leave. Millions of them did. Several of my closest friends have been working with those displaced families ever since. They are scattered all over Europe in large concentrations. The children have gone to school and become acculturated to the locale where the family has been transplanted. The mothers have found jobs and careers. Tens of thousands of these families have no husband or father to go home to in Ukraine because he did not survive the war. Not only that, vast numbers of them have no home to go back to. Villages throughout the Donbas region have been bombarded into oblivion. And in many cases, the rubble that remains will likely end up under Russian control in a final settlement of the war. Those who fled the country have no interest whatsoever in living under Russian authority. As a result, there is a serious question as to how many of these displaced families will return to Ukraine. Whether they do or not, Ukraine's immediate future will be sorely lopsided demographically. If they choose not to return, the demographic problem is only exaggerated. In either event, with an underrepresentation of young families, the challenge of rebuilding communities and commerce is compounded. The level of casualties during the war creates another post-war predicament that we as Americans could hardly anticipate. Ukraine, and Russia as well, are very unfriendly environments for people with missing limbs or arms, and a near impossible place to function for those who are wheelchair-bound. You can go days at a time on the streets of Ukraine without seeing anyone who is severely handicapped. They are all trapped in their apartment. Private homes are a rare commodity in Ukraine. The vast majority of the population, especially in cities and larger villages, live in high-rise apartments popularly known as Khrushchevskys because they were built in mass during the Khrushchev era. If these buildings have an elevator, and many do not, it is so tiny that navigating a wheelchair into it is a frustrating chore, if not an impossible one. The stairs, meanwhile, are steep, many flights irregular in the width and height of the individual steps, poorly lit, and a severe struggle for anyone on crutches. If you are lucky enough to live on the first floor of the building, you at least have fewer obstacles to overcome in getting outside. But there you encounter an equally difficult situation. Because water flows through the streets in great volumes during the spring thaw, street curbs in Ukraine are quite high, 2 or 3 times as high as the curbs you would typically see in most American neighborhoods. Navigating them is nigh unto impossible in a wheelchair. There are no sidewalk ramps at intersections, no ramps into the stores and buildings, and steps in entryways everywhere. Adding to the problem is that major intersections do not have pedestrian crossings at ground level. People on foot must use a below-ground crossover. It has a dozen steps going down, another dozen returning to ground level on the other side, and no ramps anywhere to assist. Therefore, when people lose full use of their legs, their only option is to remain at home and vegetate. After my first trips to Ukraine, I realized that there were so few disabled people on the street that it caught my attention whenever I encountered one. During my years working in Ukraine, I led a team of American neurological specialists who helped the Ministry of Health develop an initial plan for rehabilitating people with spinal injuries and disabling neurological problems. At the time, there was not a single rehabilitation center anywhere in the country for people with severe spinal injuries. As we visited with community and national leaders for their input on the project, we kept running into people who saw no need for what we were designing. They would tell us, "We don't have a lot of crippled people in Ukraine. How many do you see on the street?" In other words, a hostile infrastructure prevented disabled people from going into public, but their absence on the street led the majority to conclude that there were not many handicapped men and women in their town. To my knowledge, none of our rehabilitation plans were ever implemented before the war broke out. Now, with the disabilities resulting from the conflict, the number of disabled people in Ukraine has expanded exponentially. Perhaps the sheer number of casualties from the war will finally force the populace to recognize the infrastructure problems for people with disabilities. Even with that awareness, however, the sheer cost of renovating elevators, entryways, and pedestrian crossings to make them handicap accessible will take ages to complete and at tremendous cost. The loss of these potential workers to the post-war labor force will further compound the challenge of rebuilding the nation's economy. But outside the cities, entire communities will struggle to re-establish themselves after the war. Ukraine has some of the richest land for agriculture in the world. Its national income thrives on the export of wheat, sunflower seed, and other agricultural products. Yet at least one-third of the arable land in the war zone cannot be farmed now. The ground is so infested with mines and unexploded ordnance that every step is hazardous. Western intelligence agencies are forecasting that an all-out effort to dispose of these threats would require a minimum of 7 to 8 years at a cost of as much as $80 billion. It took Croatia years to remove mines left by the Serbs in the war between those two Balkan nations following the collapse of Yugoslavia. The conditions in Croatia, however, were nowhere nearly as daunting as the situation Ukraine faces. Given where the battle lines are drawn today, I will be surprised if Ukraine recovers the entirety of the Donbas region in a final peace accord. Donbas is noted for its coal mines, among other things. They are everywhere in that part of Ukraine, and coal mining is a dominant occupation. From a distance, one might anticipate that Ukraine would be able to capitalize on any coal mines that it recovers to help fund post-war recovery. Unfortunately, the coal mines will not yield income anytime soon. Less than a year into the war, not a single coal mine was operative in Donbas. Entrances and infrastructure for the mines had been systematically destroyed. Many mines are beyond repair. Others were already too depleted prior to the Russian invasion to justify the cost of rehabilitating them. The estimates that I've seen indicate that even the mines which can be restored will not be back online for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. For some, the restoration will be even longer. Meanwhile, a small fortune will have to be invested to repair them. The rebuilding of bombed-out villages and cities must proceed, therefore, without adequate manpower to rebuild manufacturing. With vast stretches of land unavailable for agriculture, none of the nation's coal mines available, and a greatly reduced population on which to base economic recovery. The war has been costly. Recovery will be no less so, and will probably take decades. Money from taxes can never bring in sufficient funds for the recovery and rehabilitation of the country. That's why the proposed partnership with the U.S. to exploit precious earth resources is a critical component of peace plans being floated at present. Ukraine will be starved for revenue. The joint enterprise with Western investors gives the nation a lasting stream of much-needed income. If this joint venture comes about, the Ukrainians will make the most of it. When I did my first podcast on the war in the first days after the Russian invasion, I predicted that the West would be amazed at the ingenuity of the Ukrainians. My prophecy has proven spot on. Who could have expected a country with no navy to force the Russian navy to retreat from the war zone? Who could have foreseen that Ukrainians would use off-the-shelf hardware to develop sophisticated drone warfare tactics that even the Pentagon is learning from? Who could have foreseen how the Ukrainian military would push the Russians back on many fronts using improvised weapon systems? Their spirit of ingenuity and resilience has been on display throughout the war. They will need to tap into both like never before in the post-war world that lies ahead. A PDF transcript of this podcast is available at upsizeyourleadership.com/episodes. Find the program in the index and click on the link to download scripts. Thanks again for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. I look forward to visiting again next week. Until then, find some way every day to upsize your leadership.